Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. I'm a psychotherapist and the author and the originator of the Awareness Integration Theory. And hello to Sean, our director in the studio. This is a show about what matters most in our lives, our minds, thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. Today, I will share the tip of the week about letting go of the significance we give to some events in our past. And then I will share with you reasons that makes forgiving someone so hard in the Ask Me segment. I also will bring you tips about how to talk to your kids about scary events from the University of Colorado in the research segment. And then, are you ready? I am so honored to bring you Dr. Irvin Yalom. He's an American existential psychiatrist who is the emeritus professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. He's the author of more than 25 books, some of them amazing books in psychotherapy textbooks, such as existential psychotherapy and group psychotherapy, and the rest are out of this world novels, which have been translated to multiple languages. He is my guru, and I am so honored to have him on my show. Today, we will be talking about his latest book, A Matter of Death and Life. It's a very personal experience and an interview, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I have. I love to hear from you, so connect with me through my website, fujian.com, and follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. But here's the tip of the week. Hello, this is Dr. Fujian again. This is the tip of the week. This week, I've been observing the concept of letting go. Why is it so hard to let go of some people or things and not the others? What makes us hold such an attachment to one person and not another? How come we hold on to some memory and let go of many more? I look back in my life and see certain happy memories are there as a video, side by side with some sad memories. But what happened to all the other ones, all the other memories that were part of my life? I also noticed that with my clients, there are certain emotionally charged memories from the past that are always there to be returned to, while others just don't seem important. It appears that when an event is charged with intense levels of emotions, whether positive or negative, and it hangs around, and other events just kind of like get pruned away during our sleep time, or just fade away as non-important as time passes. I also have noticed that depending on the meaning that we have given to the event, the decisions we made about ourselves and our surrounding and others, we give significance to that particular event. So the event itself is only a trigger for the origination of our perception, creating certain opinions about it, right? The meaning we give it is the origin of the significance for our attachments. When we become aware of that significance given to the decision about the self, ourselves, and our surroundings, then we can explore and challenge the decision to see if it applies to the reality of who we are today. Challenging the significance to see if in the bigger scheme of life, including our strength, skills, and resiliency, we possess
still holds relevance. So, for example, if you're still holding on to a memory in your childhood about your mom or your dad behaving in a particular way with you, observe what the child in your memory of that event thought and felt about him or herself and others. What decisions did the child make about him or herself and others? Is it true now? The same decision? Is it applicable now? And based on your skills, strength, and your daily outcomes, do you see that decision still relevant? If you determine that the decision is no longer necessary and does not hold value for your present life, you may let go of the significance you assign to it. You may upgrade the decision to one that makes a difference today for you and furthers your life toward fulfillment. To investigate more in how you can you have given a significance to the past issues and ways of letting it go, go to my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. Dr. Fujian here in the Ask Me segment. Thank you so much for sending your questions to me. A gentleman has asked, why is it so hard to forgive another person? In a study done at Ohio State University with 184 college students, found that revenge is more enjoyable on TV, film, and stories than forgiveness. However, the study also showed that a fair and just retribution is an intuitive moral standard that comes to us easily and naturally. So why is forgiving so hard? At times we have not let go of our anger toward being harmed. We may have felt belittled or powerless in the way we were harmed, and holding on to our anger may be the only way we hold on to our sense of being in control. We may also hold on to our anger to satisfy our sense of justice so that we don't accept their behavior, and also to hold on punishing them in our own world. Like, if we forgive them, we have let the person who harmed us off the hook. We may want to see them feel the way we did, get harmed the same way, so that they get it and feel empathy for us or become accountable for what they've done to us. We hope to get an apology, be seen and heard, cared for, before we would be willing to let go. At times we may see that person as all bad if they were able to harm us and not see any goodness to hang on to. But the truth is, the anger that we hold also hurts us. So now we end up hurting ourselves. Fostering compassion for ourselves first, for being hurt, then for the other person who may also be hurting inside, and probably that is why they're confused and attempt to hurt other people, will let us free. Holding on to a grudge in your own head does not punish them, I promise you. The anger of revenge or the powerlessness of being a victim holds us hostage. Letting go and allowing the process of healing to happen is the remedy. A commitment to be free and happy will entice us to move forward and live our days in a fulfilled way and not get stuck in another person's anger or behavior. You deserve to be happy. Even if you were harmed, you deserve to pull back up and make your own life fulfilled and happy, and not allow anybody else to determine how you feel about yourself. And let me share with you the latest research, How to Talk with Kids About Scary Events. The Center for Resilience and Well-Being in schools at the Institute of Behavioral Science at University of Colorado at Boulder, has offered the latest tips that is featured in the neuroscience news. When scary or sad things happen in the world, whether thousands of miles away, in your state, your town, your backyard, or your home, kids look to the adults that surround them to help them feel safe and understand what is happening. This can feel tricky and challenging, particularly when the adults themselves are also responding, making sense of the same experience. So before talking with your youth, check in with yourself. How am I feeling? What do I need? So that you are calm and grounded during the conversation. Just as your youth have feelings about the same experiences, so do you and all the adults. Checking in with yourself first will also help you to be ready to address any questions the youth might have for you. It's okay not to have all the answers to the questions. Your warm and open presence is the most important thing. You can even say, I don't know, let's go find out, or I don't know yet, and we might have more news later. As you approach the conversation, it can be helpful to start with a goal in mind. An overall goal is to create a safe space for youth to share their feelings, questions, reactions, and experiences about the scary, sad thing, and to feel your support. You might ask yourself, how might I be helpful? How can I help my child to feel safe? Is there some important information for them to know? Is there anything they can learn? Is there any misinformation to correct? What might my child already know or think about the situation? So keep coming back to messages of safety and support and willingness to keep talking and sharing. Share simple facts and information about what happened and balance it with information about how adults and other people in the community or the community systems may have stepped forward to help and create safety. Match the type and the amount of information to the developmental level of your youth. Ask open-ended questions about what they may have already heard and correct any type of misinformation. Keep this part of the discussion brief, simple, and clear. Multiple short conversations can often be more powerful than a single long conversation. Ask helpful questions to learn more about the young person's thoughts, feelings, perspectives, and needs. The goal is to gain an understanding of the young person's experience and not one of fact-finding or learning about specific details of the situation. Questions we ask should be open-ended and focused on their experience, emotions, and perspectives, such as, what was that like for you? How are you feeling? What are you thinking or wondering about? Do you have any questions or worries? And don't project your own stuff onto them. Just be there for them. Depending on their developmental stage, what they understand out of that and what their fears are might be completely different for you as an adult. Then normalize and validate their feelings. This doesn't mean that you're normalizing the bad things that happen, but instead you're affirming that whatever they're feeling is normal and okay. You might say, that makes sense. I understand. Other people feel the same way too, or you're not alone. Be aware of how much you're checking your social media or the media when you are with your youth, and be aware of how much they are tracking the event in the media to monitor and reduce negative impacts. While it is part of our culture to be consistently connected to the news and social media, if your youth sees you that you are checking your phone or television constantly, they may be more likely to do so, and they might constantly become more and more traumatized. I hope that helped. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fushan Zain, and I am so excited and honored to have Dr. Irvin Yalom with me. He's an American existential psychiatrist who is the Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry at Stanford University, the author of more than 25 books that have been translated in multiple languages. It has been the honoree of 7 awards, including the Oscar Feistler Award and the International Sigmund Freud Award for psychotherapy. Today, we will be talking about his latest book, A Matter of Death and Life. Welcome to the show, Dr. Yalom.
Very glad to be here. Nice to see you again.
Yes. I was sharing with you that you have been my guru. And one of the things that I just want you to know is that you have made me fall in love with psychotherapy. Part of the reason is that your books are so real in experience. And this is what I also experienced in this book. What's interesting for me is when you've written about psychotherapy, it's as if the mind of a psychotherapist is right there for everyone to see. Mm-hmm. A lot of the books that I had read, even including your, one of your own books, Staring at the Sun, that you were talking about the anxiety of death. Mm-hmm. You really talk about every kind of emotion and thought process that shows up as us as a human being. And in the book, A Matter of Death and Life, which has just been published and out, this experience of two people facing death and life and the choices that they make and every process is so real that I've never experienced anything like this. So first of all, thank you. Thank you for you and Marilyn for writing this book. Can you share with us what came about for Marilyn and you to choose to actually write this book?
Well, it really started, I know that almost the moment it started, we were walking. We live just a block from a park, and we often walk in this park. And Marilyn, this was after she was ill for a few months. She had a disease called multiple myeloma, which is a cancer of the blood cells. And she was already getting ill, and I was already needing to be with her a good deal and take her to the hospital once a week for treatment. But she said, you know, I think we should write a book about what's happening now and for the next few months. So let's write this book together. I'll write a chapter, and then you write a chapter. And I said to her, I think that's a wonderful idea. It's a great idea for you to do that now. And it'll really, occupy your time and attention. And I think you'll write a fine book. But right now I'm starting another book. You know, I'm writing a book of stories. So I think it's a good idea for you to write this book. And she said, oh, no, we're going to write this book together. You know, she was very, very strong-willed. But we're going to write this book together, and you can forget about that other book for a while. And so we started to write that book. And so we wrote that book for several months until she died, writing alternating chapters. And then after that, the book is called A Matter of Death and Life. So it's a book about her death and then my life afterwards. So then I started writing very, very soon after she died, and after the cemetery, I started writing chapters about examining what was going on in my mind and what my grief was like, and it was a very deep grief. I didn't think my prognosis was too good. I've worked a lot with grieving patients, but I've never met with anyone who had as long and intense a relationship as I did. Since we met when we were 14, and now we're approaching 90. So that's a very, very long, long relationship. So that's what the name of this book is all about.
You talk about, and she talks about in the book, about regretless life and how to, as you're facing death, one of the ways to calm down the anxiety was to look back at life and look at a type of life we've led. And the enjoyment we've had, and what we have touched upon other people. And you've said in your book that you've had anxiety about death since you were very young, and you were going through your own psychotherapy with Rollo May, and constantly talking about anxiety. And your other books are about that. What was different with your own experience, as you've written also in the book, as you have faced her death? Someone you love, someone you were together all the time. You talked about You were always holding hands together since you were young. And your identities were so intertwined, even when it came to your writing books together constantly, and she would be editing yours and going back and forth. What were your experiences about facing death with, and then going back and looking at your life?
About facing her death, you mean? Yeah. Yeah, well, it was... She's always been really healthy. This is the first time she ever really been sick in all of our life together. But she was extremely brave about that. Always, it was quite remarkable. And when she had a very serious illness, but multiple myeloma can be treated, and many people will live 10, 20 years with that treatment. But some people don't. And for some reason or other, none of the medications really worked with her. In fact, they always made her a good bit worse. And so finally, they were saying that there really isn't any other treatment available for you except some very, very drastic treatment, which she was not willing to undergo and probably would not have been helpful either. And so... She was quite courageous with that, and she decided that when it got to be more than she could bear, she wanted to help the physician to help her die, which is possible in California. It's different all over the world. There are some states in the U.S. where you can't do that, and you couldn't do that in California several years ago. And so when she was feeling that this was as far as she could go with it, and she was in too much pain, physical pain as well as psychological pain, so she asked she asked the physician to help her die, and you needed two physicians to sign that, and they did, and so the physician that was helping her at a hospice gave her a potion to drink, and I was right with her. She wanted the whole family with her. All of our four children were with her, side by side with her, and she drank the potion and died. All I could do was to watch her, and I counted her breathing, and she took 16 breaths, and then she died. It was so quick and so merciful for her. I'd like that kind of death for myself, really. So that's what happened. As soon as she took her last breath, I leaned over and kissed her on the forehead, and I wrote in the book that that it was an icy kiss. She was already cold even 1 minute after she died. That line was the strongest line in the book for me. It always moves me when I think about it. You know,
he kept saying, and you said it also in the book, and we got this phrase from Nietzsche, where there's a right to die.
Can't have
a time to die.
I'm not quite hearing you. Okay, can we stop for 1 minute? Okay.
So the concept of the sentence that Nietzsche kept saying, and you kept saying it, is the right time to die. What is a right time to die? When is it a right time to die?
Well, I'll tell you what the right time to die for her was, that life had no meaning, no pleasure for her. She was in constant pain. She had ruptured some kind of disc on her back, and she was in great pain. There was no pleasure for her, and I know if I had felt the way she felt, then I would have taken the same path as she did. That life was totally unpleasant for her at that point for quite some period of time. She suffered a great deal in this last year of her life. She hardly ever was sick in her life, extremely healthy. So anyway, I did my best to take care of her, and we would spend one day a week each at the hospital, and getting these medications that would take her several hours to administer. So it was a very, very hard year for her.
One of the interesting things about one of the chapters that she wrote was in for me was that she was talking about the different items around the house that she wanted to think about who she was going to give it to. And then she kept looking at, well, the stories that I have and the experience that I have with any of these objects that are here will never be the same story and the experience that is passed on. Everyone will have their own experience of whatever is here. So it's interesting what I got from your book is that no matter what happens and no matter what you try to pass on, your own individual experience of your own in this bubble will always be your unique one. And somehow you're trying to share that with everyone around you, and that depends on what they will take from it.
Right.
And that's what I also got from many of your books, is you bring an experiential aspect of someone's internal process out into the world, and then each person kind of takes their own experience from it.
Yeah, each of the books that she had, each of the things we bought reminded her of where we bought that, what part of the what part of the world we lived in at that point. Although I had one job throughout our whole life, really, which was I was a professor at Stanford, but we spent every sabbatical year possible, and she loved to go to France, and we'd spend, often we had a sabbatical year, we we split it. And I picked 6 months, and she picked 6 months. I picked 6 months to go to a tropical island where I could write unbothered and go. I loved to scuba dive and do that, and then she'd spend, her 6 months was almost always at Paris. Eventually we got, we shared a apartment in Paris with one of our good friends, and we lived in Paris for during that time. She was a she was a French professor, very gifted in languages, got her PhD in comparative literature, French and German at Johns Hopkins. So she always wanted to go back to France. I have no linguistic ability whatsoever. She always used to say that I managed to mispronounce every French word I ever heard, and it was probably true. It wasn't my favorite place to go, but islands weren't her favorite place to go either. So we made a bargain about that.
I also really got a lot of experience of loss throughout the book, in the way that she was going through every experience of letting go, whether it was her body or whether it was her belongings. And I was also experiencing your conversation about loss. As you said, every day that I go forward and I think I'm forgetting something, and then my memory of these pieces are gone, it feels like there's another part of me that also dies. So forgetting things are also as if it's death. And so can you share a little bit about these steps almost of letting go and the loss, and then accepting the loss, and then letting go again, going through the grief, acceptance, and then the next one? Because it doesn't appear that it stops. We keep letting go and leaving and experiencing the loss.
Well, one part of that question is really very pertinent to us, because Marilyn had an extraordinary memory. I knew it from the very beginning that when she died, she was going to take a great deal of our past with her. And it's happening, it happens very frequently. Somebody mentions a certain part of the world, and I have, oh, I don't think I've been there. And one of my children, you and Mother went there. And I knew that she was going to take my past with her away. And there was so much, I think there was some island, and I thought we were there, but I wasn't sure. And my daughter-in-law was with me over the weekend, and she was telling me about that we were at several of the Hawaiian Islands for a while. I'd forgotten that entirely. So yeah, Marilyn's cooking some of my characteristics. But I knew that even before she went, I was going to miss a lot. And of course, Marilyn and I shared so much back from when we first met. We were in junior high school at that point. And all that now is, I can't share that with anyone. So I miss that very much. I met Marilyn when I was in the ninth grade. I had just moved from where I'd spent my first 14 years in a very nasty neighborhood in Washington, D.C. My father had a grocery store, and we lived over the grocery store, but it was a dangerous part of town. So we moved to this junior high school, and a friend of mine said to me, well, you know, Marilyn Pollock is having a party at her house. Why don't we go? So I went there, and we couldn't get into the house because the stairs going up to her porch were totally crowded with people. And my friend, who didn't mind doing such things, said, just come in through the window. So I climbed in through the window, and I saw her across the room. I went up to her, introduced myself, said hello. It's the first time I ever talked to a girl, I think. And I said, I just crawled through your window. And anyway, we made a date for the following two days away. And we went to something called the Hot Shops in Washington, where they made ice cream sundaes. And she told me that she had skipped school that day. And I said, what? You skipped school? She said, yes. The night before, she'd stayed up all night finishing up Gone with the Wind, the novel. And as soon as she said that, I was absolutely fixated on her, because I spent much of my 14 years of life in the library reading. I never stopped reading. She's the first person I ever met who seemed to treasure books as much as I do. So our friendship and our romance really started with a book. We started reading and sharing our books with one another. And so our life started with a book, and our life ended with writing this book together.
What is your experience now after you wrote the book, after she's been gone almost a year now? What are your experiences now as someone who has been grieving and is post-grief?
Well, that's what the second part of the book is really about. I'm just sort of following myself and examining my mind and what's going in it. But I've been feeling very numb, depressed, and heavy. And one thing I started to do was, as I lay in bed or lay in my living room, I see my own books there in the bookcase. So I decided I'll start to reread my books. So the first time I'd done that, really. So I started reading my books, and that was quite wonderful therapy for me. As I started to read the books, I'm saying, hey, this is, I write this? This is pretty good, I thought. So I was quite proud of the novels that I wrote. And I had a strange experience there. I think I described this in the book. I picked up a book called Mama and the Meaning of Life. And I started reading it, and there was a book of stories. And one of the stories had the title, I think it was Eight Advanced Lessons in the Therapy of Grief. And I said, what? And I'd forgotten that I'd written that story at all. So it was a story of my treating a woman who was a professor at Stanford. She had lost her husband. Before that, she had lost her brother. And she was in deep grief. And she was very angry at that time, angry at the universe for having taken this away from her. And she got very annoyed with me. She would say to me, oh, you're sitting there in that pink striped shirt, and nothing ever happens to you, nothing bad. How do you know what I'm feeling? So I'd argue with her. We would yell at each other practically. You know, I'd say, oh, I got to be depressed to treat a depressed patient. Is that what you're saying? I got to be schizophrenic to treat a schizophrenic. And she held her position. But you know, now, as I'm going through all these stages of grief Now I don't know what she's looking like, but now I think she was right, probably. But I couldn't fully experience what she was feeling, and I think now I probably could have been more helpful to her.
I think part of what I've always experienced through your books.
Yeah.
Dr. Yalom, when going through your books, one of the most amazing concepts is the real experience that you share. So there's a way that you write that it gives a crisp concept of an experience. I remember reading When Nietzsche Wept, and I read that in 3 days, and then I couldn't put it down, and I kept going. I think that was my first, besides, you know, the group therapy and existential therapy, which I read as a psychotherapist, but from your novels, that was my first experience, and then started reading all of your other books and novels. You have a keen observation of experience, and that's also coming from when you're sitting in a room of with people almost like experiencing their experiences and then jotting it down and then bringing it into the novel. Is that, am I accurate in that assumption?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a talent of that type of keen observation. Can you share with people or some of our audience who are also therapists in how to produce that type of keen observation that you have?
Well, that's a very hard question for me to answer. I've just always loved to write. As I was saying earlier, as a teenager, I just loved writing poetry to myself. It was, and all my life, and sometimes I thought, well, maybe I just should have been a writer, you know, and then spent my life writing novels. Whenever I think that, I immediately say, yeah, but well, you wouldn't have had anything to write about, you know, this is the best profession in the world for a writer, because you really get deep inside of people. But writing is a great pleasure to me, and I think the thing that I enjoyed most of all in my life was writing the novels. I was just lost in the novel for a year or two. It was a great experience, and I have the same feeling now. I'm always reading novels. At that point, it's always a great pleasure for me. And in fact, writing is just keeping me alive right now over the last couple of years. I wrote that book with Marilyn, and I'm writing another book now, and that's all that I look forward to every day. People come to visit me, and I'm just waiting for them to leave so I get back to my writing. So yes, it's a great pleasure for me. And as I read each of my novels, I try to remember, oh, where was I when I wrote this? Without Marilyn, for the most part, I've forgotten that. But there are times that I can remember where I was when I wrote that. But those were the high points of my entire life.
When you look at the gift you have given the world of psychotherapy, what is it that you wanted to give this world? And what do you think you have already?
Well, lately what I've been focusing on, and in the writing I'm doing right now, I've been focusing on the whole issue of how much of oneself does the therapist share with others. So I was brought up in a different tradition. I think I described in the book, when I started my residency at Johns Hopkins, it was everybody entered into analysis at that point. All psychiatrists were expected to go into psychoanalysis, and so I did that. And the dean of psychoanalysts in Baltimore was an elderly woman named Olive Smith. So I saw her 4 times a week for 3 years. That's 600 hours of therapy, and she was a very traditional analyst. She sat at the edge of the couch. I lay down on the couch. I couldn't see her, and so I really twisted my neck all the way back. She shared nothing of herself whatsoever. I never spoke about any aspect of herself. And after those 3 years are over, I thought, this is not a good way to do therapy. I got very little from that. And so since then, I've been very different. I share a great deal of myself. I disclose a good bit of myself, far more than the average therapist does. And I'm doing that right now. I'm doing single session consultations. And I always, always focus on what's going on between the two of us. I grew up in a time in psychiatry, at a time when there was a big American contribution to psychotherapy, which was the interpersonal movement, which was started by a man named Harry Stack Sullivan, who was on the East Coast of there, and Karen Harline, who were my heroes, and I read very, very carefully. But we're focusing not so much on your fantasies about early life and the first couple of years of life in Queensbridge at home. We're doing a history of the people that you were relating to. Who are your friends? Who are your chums? Who are the most important people in your life? Who do you disclose to? And so that has a tremendous meaning for group therapy, too, which I became very interested in. My work in group therapy is to take a look at how people in the group are relating to each of those other people. That's all I want to do in the group. And you learn a great deal of how you relate to the other people in your life through that. So I focus very much on the interpersonal skills. And so in my therapy now, I've always focused a great deal on what's happening between the two of us. And I've got to take my share of that responsibility too. Well, how am I presenting to the patient? What are you feeling about me? What are you seeing me doing? So, and if I see one patient after the other and people are relating extremely differently to me, and I feel I'm being the same way, well, I feel like that's some other stuff that they're putting on to me. So I tend to disclose that every single, I'm doing a book of stories now. I see consultation. I'm not seeing many because I'm getting very old, but I see one person a day, usually 6 or 7 a week, and for a single hour, and offer all I can in that consultation. I don't see them the second time. I make referrals to them, tell them what I think they should be doing in their as they pursue therapy. So I focus very much on the here and now, which means what is going on between the two of us. Almost always in a consultation, I'll take a jump into the here and now. Let's take a look at how this session is going. How are you feeling about my questions? What's happening between the two of us? I always will focus on the here and now. And I find that's where the painter is. That's where things get galvanized and that people become far more interested in that. They look at, as we begin to take a look at the in-betweenness between me and the patient. And I will do a lot of self-disclosure. I've told that story about meeting my wife. There's another story in there that I tell very frequently to people I consult with, which had to do with the fact that my father had this store, and we lived over top of the store, and it was a very dangerous neighborhood in Washington. It's just by sheer coincidence. My father had a grocery store one block away from my father's, but the family lived in another part of town. He thought it was a nasty part of town, didn't want his children to grow up in that. So Marilyn had this very, very nice childhood, and she was adored by everyone, and everything was very safe for her, and she got French lessons and elocution lessons. Whereas I was always anxious and felt it was dangerous. I lived in a black neighborhood. My parents didn't want me playing with black children. It was a mess. So Marilyn had such social skills. And the most important thing here, though, is that she never even knew what anxiety was. She never had to see a therapist. She was always extremely skillful all of her social dealings, whereas I was just full of anxiety all the time and began therapy many different times to deal with that. am in write down. So what, you know, my grief, I'm seeing a therapist. So the point of that is, I always tell people, you know, that these early years of life, where you're not getting the support, the love that you, that the children need, that doesn't go away. It's going to be with you. You're going to need to be in therapy several times a year, just as I have. Well, I tell that story almost every time I see a patient. And I think it's important to let people know they've got to take care of themselves, get some help. And you had some really rough patches in your life, and you need some help looking at that.
I think in your books, most of your books that you have written, my experience was that you were sharing the part of the therapist, the mind and the heart and the experience of the therapist in the book, although you weren't maybe using it in your sessions, but in your books, we were experiencing as reader what happens inside the experience of going back and forth. And I'm sensing that you brought that into the session every minute now. Whatever's going on here, you're hearing it and bringing it into the session. Has that made it richer for you and the client?
Yes, I think so. I've always done that. I don't quite know where all that came from, but when I was at Stanford and I was starting to lead groups of patients, but I was also a teacher, so I had my psychiatric residents, about 9 or 10 of them a year, so the first year residents watched me do this group, and they were behind this one with a two-way mirror, so they could see the patients of course couldn't see them, but the patients, you know, I was uneasy about that. They gave me permission, they knew they were being observed. But they were feeling very uneasy about these people watching what were they saying about them afterwards. So I took a really bold step. I don't know if anyone ever did this before, but I said to the patients, okay, listen, you can watch my discussion with the residents. At the end of the group, I went with all my students into the group of 10 students, and we talked about the group. It was all the group members went into the observation room, and they watched us. Well, that was revolutionary. First of all, it was unusually open for therapy, but I always did this, and I found it, without exception, always terribly useful. It got the students on their toes, because they knew they were being observed and were uncomfortable about that, but the patients really, really liked hearing this discussion, although they wanted a few more minutes after to talk about what they were feeling about the students there. So it went on like that. But I was very much dedicated to being real with the patients and letting them see what was going on in my mind.
Yes, lately, since my memory is not that great, I have to write notes while the clients are talking. Many times they keep looking at my hand and it's like, what are you writing? And I read to them, I said, exactly what you said, this is what it is. And it almost brings a lot of safety and connectedness. And then after a while, they're like, write this one. Write it exactly the way I say it. Now, you know, it's almost like the notes and them and I become a part of the whole game. It's as if they wanted now documented something that is important for them.
So, that's terrific. I like doing that a lot. I used to send, after the group meetings, I would send, dictate a summary of the session, but mail it to all the patients afterwards. I also wrote a book called, Everyday Gets a Little Closer. I was seeing a patient who was very, very frightened of people, and their interpersonal skills were very poor, and I suggested to her that we write a summary of each session. I'll write a summary of the session, you write a summary, and we'll switch. And I'll read yours and you'll read mine. And so we did that for a year. She happened to be a very good writer. And so after we did that for a while, I said, you know, my wife said that. She actually went on a ski trip and she wasn't skiing at that point. But she still let me read all the summaries and thought, you know, this might be a good book.
Yes.
And I wrote that book together called Everybody Gets a Little Closer. And she read all my summaries and all of her recordings. And then next week we talked about what the impact of reading them were. So it was circular, but it kept a strong focus on the relationship.
Dr. Yalom, if you wanted people to read A Matter of Death and Life, can you tell them what is it that they might, that you wanted to share with them? What was the message in this book? Although Marilyn gave the suggestion, and she wanted people who read it to really gain something out of it. And what did you want people who are going to read it gain from it?
First of all, I should say that I got a lot from it, from writing it. It was something that was, it made me feel better as this was going on. So one thing that stands out in my mind is that I think it spells out to people what loss feels like, what grief feels like. I really just focused so hard on all the stages that I was going through, if you will, you know, after Marilyn died, how numb I felt, and that I had all these obsessions coming to my mind that I could never get out of my mind. These various stages there. So, in a sense, it was highly therapeutic for me to write that. It was like giving myself medicine in a way, and I think that was true for Marilyn too. We read each other's chapters as we went on. She didn't do much editing for that, but she was probably too ill. But, you know, she was always my first editor. She always read my first draft of the book. She was a terrific editor. Now I'm having to do without that, but I think I'm probably continuing to write as well. But I did like 10 different drafts for each story that I write.
In 1 minute, we're ending the time. Is there anything that you want the audience to know about you or about the book or any of your books that we haven't shared and you really want them to know?
No, it's just that the books are a great pleasure for me. I'm writing a book now. And I just can't wait to get to my desk every morning. I'll sit down at my desk at 8 o'clock and suddenly it's 11 o'clock and 3 hours just passed. And I'm very grateful that I can still write. And I get very anxious when I think of what the next year will be like. Maybe I will lose that skill. So the writing is a lifesaver for me.
So everyone, Dr. Urban Yalom, whose latest book and life, my suggestion is if you have not read his book, please read every novel that he has written. I think you are one of the most amazing novelists that I've read. I don't read novels a lot, but I've read almost all of yours, and I can't put them down because to me, it's real. It's like every experience that a human has. And everyone who will read your book, to me, I'm projecting my own experience to them, but they enjoy the concept of psychotherapy. A lot of people get intimidated when they think about psychotherapy or psychotherapists, or when they are going to a space where they have to really face their struggles, but the way that you put it in your novels, it brings it into such a beautiful relationship of two human beings who are there and one is there to support the other, but always we get to learn from every experience. And that is what your books offer to the world. Everyone that has ever read your book, they have become a lifetime fan. So, I truly thank you for the gift that you've given the world and mostly the psychotherapist. You've brought existential world to us as a psychotherapist. You wrote the group therapy Bible for all of us to learn. And you brought the humanness of a psychotherapist into the light. So I thank you forever for that.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you, Fujin. It always is.
Same here. And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.